Hey gang, Kevin Strange here.
Jamie Daniels.
Listen, we're going to be radically changing the way the Patreon works in a few months, but for now, you come in at the $1 level, the $1 level, and you get access to all of my audiobooks, right?
Right.
You get Jorek and the Shaugus Steel, Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms of Vic. You get Cotton Candy.
McHumans. Humans Under the Bed.
You get
Computer Face.
Computer Face, and you get Holy Matrimony. These are hours and hours and hours of audiobooks. As if that wasn't enough, only for $1, and not a dollar each. It's a dollar a month. A dollar a month gets you access to all of that, plus the Overrun episodes of our sister podcast, Watching with Strangers. We do a weekly Overrun podcast every single week. You get a new episode of that show. It's ridiculous not to jump in, help us, support the podcast. We're trying to get 20 patrons in the month of May. And I promise you, in the next couple months, it's going to be worth it. We're going to convert this over. It's going to be a book club, gang. It's going to have merch. I'm going to be giving away t-shirts and buttons and stickers and novels, exclusive novellas and books from Kevin Strange. Just get in now. Get these cool podcasts and audiobooks and stick around because it's going to get only better.
Right? Travis is my sister.
All right, there you go.
Life is a game, so fight for survival and see if you're worth it.
Again, with a new episode of the Watching with Strangers podcast with me, Kevin Strange,
and me, Travis,
the Encyclopedia Britannica of cult movies. You weren't a very good encyclopedia last week.
I wasn't.
We got to do some house cleaning before we move on to our next movie. I apologize, gang, for any of you that listened to last week's episode concerning Albert Pune's nemesis. Missed a couple real big things in our discussion.
Did we have a couple boners?
Number one, how many minutes did we spend on Tim Thomerson?
Quite a few.
How many times did we talk about Doll Man?
Quite a few.
How many times did we mention that Albert Pune directed Doll Man?
This many.
Zero times. We apologize for that.
Game. I did bring up that he directed a different Charles Band movie in Arcade.
You know what else? Do you remember what the name of the character from the action movie that Tim Thomerson played?
Which action movie?
That we talked about a Tim Thomerson action movie. And he played
Trancers?
No. Different, because he's Jack Death in Trancers. Right. And he played, it's not Brick Bronson. What was his name?
From Dollman.
Brick, yeah, what was
his name? It's Brick something.
Well, that's the name of his character from... We talked briefly about the action movie that Albert Pune directed with Tim Thomerson, and it's got the same name. He took the character from his action movie, and now I'm bonering up all over the place because I don't remember the name of the action movie.
There's boners everywhere up here.
I don't remember the name of the action movie, and I don't remember Brick's last name, but there's a huge connection between Albert Pune and Tim Thomerson. They've done a ton of movies together, including them taking this same character and putting him in the Doll Man universe, in the Full Moon universe. It takes you... What? You're still over there looking stuff up.
I'm trying to figure out what movie you're talking about.
Are you on IMDb?
I am.
Why have you still not got it?
Because Albert Pune's done a lot more movies than you would think. You're supposed to be the expert, aren't you?
I should have had all this up already.
Yeah, way to go, man.
I'm bonering up.
We're just look up Tim. Boners flying all over the place.
Thomerson. He was in Fear and Loathing in Las
Vegas. Is that what you're talking about?
No, not Heatseeker. Come on.
Kelly, man, you're supposed to be the Albert Pune expert.
Listen, why was I supposed to be the Albert Pune expert? All right, so he plays... Oh my God. Where are we?
He did!
Talk about it.
Remember I commented about how Albert Pune likes using leading men that don't speak good English?
Yeah.
Like me? He did, and I said, well, one of these days he's going to make a film with Christopher Lambert. Already done.
Brick Bardo.
Is
his name in Doll Man, but he also plays Brick Bardo in another movie.
Huh.
He plays Brick Bardo in, well, that's Doll Man versus Demonic Toys, but he plays Brick Bardo in another Albert Pune film. And we're gonna let that ride because
But the Christopher Lambert film was Mean Guns. Travis Christopher Lambert and an iced tea.
Travis ain't being any help here, so anyway, I wanted to and there's one more connection.
There's more.
Cyborg, Albert Pune's Cyborg with Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Mm-hmm.
What studio released that?
Well, the major
Canon.
One.
No, oh, it wasn't a major thing. We talked about Canon.
Yeah.
We talked about all these things last week, and we didn't put Canon with Cyborg, and we didn't put Brick Bardo and Albert Pune together with Doll Man. What's wrong with us, man? We talked extensively about Charles Band, Full Moon, and you talked about the one movie that Albert Pune directed for him, but he actually had already worked with extensively with Mr. Tim Thomerson.
You know what we're going to have to do at some point down the road, man?
Get a new encyclopedia?
Oh, I see. You want to strike, motherfucker. No, we need to come back at some point and just dedicate an episode to Albert Pune.
Well, yeah. He deserves it.
I did not know he directed the 1990 Captain America piece of junk.
Ooh, that was Albert Pune, too.
Yeah, apparently.
See, I don't know why you didn't have all this info queued up and ready to go last week.
This encyclopedia is only so thick, man.
Well, you got it's got its work cut out for this week, because this week, gang, Travis...
Kevin Slackin.
This week, Travis picked a very interesting film.
Battle Royale.
A film that I'm not sure how to even tackle. You know, we had another Asian film that I wanted to do that I proposed in the top 10.
What was that?
Called Akira. And Travis got cold feet. He backed out. He said, "We're not good enough yet. We haven't done enough podcasts yet to tackle that movie." I'm watching Battle Royale going, "How the fuck are we going to tackle this movie?" Because I literally, as soon as I turned it off, I was like, "I don't remember any of their names. I don't know who the fuck any of those people were." I watched this whole movie and I could, we talked last week about Nemesis being overwritten, like there was a really complex plot to it.
Mm-hmm.
40 plus people die in this movie.
48 to be exact.
How the fuck are we supposed to talk about that? Anyway.
We will find a way.
Gang, I have faith in Travis, the Encyclopedia Britannica of cult fiction. But for new listeners, for old listeners alike, for old listeners, you already know this. For brand new listeners that jumped in here for the Battle Royale as their first episode, as their virgin episode of Watching with Strangers, we like to do the show in roughly three phases.
Mm-hmm.
First phase, I like to sort of give a philosophical overview of the culture that surrounds any particular film that we do. The second phase, Travis likes to crunch the hard numbers. He likes to put this film in its proper place among its peers, the film's peers, when it was released, how much money it cost, and all that stuff. And then in the third phase, we generally talk about the film with heavy spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
In the first phase...
Spoilers aren't too much of an issue in this movie.
The first thing I would like to address, and I kind of touched upon this last week, but let's go ahead and jump headlong into it. Are you ready, Travis?
Yeah. Let's go.
Battle Royale,
2000.
You, Travis, you could climb to the top of a mountain, and the only thing in your possession was your Blu-ray copy of Blu-ray copy of The Hunger Games, and a portable DVD player, or Blu-ray player. And you could sit at the top of this deserted, isolated mountain, and you could put your disc into your player, and you could press play. And within seconds, a raven would fly up with a note. and or a pigeon would fly up with a
note. Is this the premise of a new book you're working on?
And you would take that note off of the foot uh-huh. of this bird, this carrier mm-hmm. bird, and you would unfurl it, and it would say, you know, they already made this movie, and it's called Battle Royale, right? Mm-hmm. The Hunger Games got so much shit from the nerd community because Battle Royale is a thing that exists. Mm-hmm. Are you one of those people?
No.
Travis, were you one of those people?
No, sir.
That had to make sure everybody knew you'd seen Battle Royale when the Hunger Games movies came out?
Because I honestly didn't really care all that much for any of the Hunger Games movies. I haven't seen them all.
They're not good.
No, they're vaguely popcorn entertainment to
me. It's a decent premise, and I really like the world. And here's why I like the structure.
They world build better than Battle Royale, but that's not what Battle Royale is about.
The world is built way better. The characters are shit. Yeah. Battle Royale is about characters. Mm. Hunger Games are about the world. The thing I like about the world, and this isn't a Hunger Games review, so I'm going to get through this real quick, but when watching that movie or reading the book, I thought they did a fascinating job of creating the stark contrast between the districts and the city.
That was, in my opinion, that was much more of interest to me than
the games themselves,
than the games themselves.
Me too. I thought, man, because the technology is so advanced in the city, and the people who live there are so decadent and weird. Not just the way they dress, not just the way they talk. Their personalities are so bizarre because they've lived isolated in this techno culture for so long, so out of touch. And you know, the people in the districts are just chopping wood, you know, living with barely if it do they have in District 12 where the main chick is from, did they even have electricity?
If they have any at all, it's gotta be limited. Yeah, but I don't recall having seen much.
I think they live by lamplight. I don't think they have any. I don't think because they don't have
vehicles. Pretty stark.
I don't think they have vehicles. I think they live off the grid in at least District 12. Anyway. It was something that annoyed the crap out of me when the Hunger Games first got popular, was people had to let you know that they have seen Battle. It was like this virtue signal for the nerd community. And that actually goes all the way back to when the movie came out. Go ahead, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I mean, and again, we want to get off of Hunger Games, but it fits really low on the rungs of the ladder of a subgenre of science fiction that we'll talk about more because of this movie. What I personally like to call social science fiction. It's not about technology or less of, it's about society.
I think that long after, I would like to say long after, but maybe it existed, but it was a small subgenre. But the subgenre I was thinking of was young adult dystopian science fiction.
Well, I mean, in terms of the literary genres, how they word those, but it's like I'm staying away from the age group. It's more just the type of subject that you're tackling rather than who the target is.
I think it's really important though that these are teenagers. I don't think it would have worked if it was a group.
We're going to talk about that in terms of Battle Royale as well, because
that's what I'm talking.
I have a lot to say about that.
That's what I'm talking about. Right. I'm talking about Battle Royale.
Oh, okay, good. So we're done with Hunger Games. Okay.
Yeah. But let's go back to when this movie was released.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the culture of the late 90s. Mm-hmm. People listening to this podcast that are under 25, they won't remember a time when anime wasn't... Anime and manga weren't a huge subculture in this country. They won't be able to recall a time when it wasn't just... When Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon and Dragon Ball Z weren't everyday knowledge. You know, these...
I mean, when you and I were kids, when we were growing up, when we first found out about the rare gem like Akira or Ghost in the Shell or Ninja Scroll, some of the better feature-length anime films, you know, to us, that was just like, oh, what is it? I don't know what it is, but it's awesome, you know? We didn't really grasp the concept yet of what anime was and how big it was, you know,
quote unquote Asian invasion.
Yeah, it hadn't come across overseas really yet.
So you already threw out some of them, but there were nothing but a handful. If you were into nerd culture, if you were a videophile, you knew about Akira, you knew about Ninja Scroll, Ghost in the Shell, and several live action movies. What year did Audition come out? Audition was
99.
Audition was a big, you know, if you're into Asian stuff, have you ever seen Audition?
Audition is great.
But I think the, well, let's name a couple others. Can you think of a few other things where...
Of anime or...
No, just Asian in general. If you were, because some of this stuff isn't Japanese, some of this stuff is Korean.
Yeah.
Also, with a few Chinese exceptions, but there's not a lot of stuff that was already over here at the time. Like now, literally now, it's impossible. You can't throw a rock. And I'll address what I think was the tipping point that brought manga and anime over here in a huge way. But can you think of the names of a couple other Asian movies that had permeated the counterculture, the like video file counterculture?
Well, I'm trying to put dates so, because I know we're talking about a specific time frame.
Well, but we're talking between the mid-90s and the very early 2000s.
Well, Ichi the Killer.
Ichi the Killer was one, but that
was... It was more of a niche, extreme.
That was even rarer. Like, if you were in Ichi the Killer... Mm. That you were hardcore. Then you knew who Takashi Miike was.
Right.
And if you knew Miike, Miike had a ton of movies out. So you've seen, what was Dead or Alive? Was that his series that he did?
I think so, yeah.
There's like three or four Dead or Alive movies. Mm-hmm. And Miike had Visitor Q and a whole bunch of other movies. And some of these are mm-hmm. pumping their way into the 2000s.
Right.
But the big, I think the damn...
They had the Ringu, which started that whole...
Yeah, whole, Ring. Whole, well, The Ring was one. The Ring was one mm-hmm. movie in The Grudge.
Well, but that was the American one.
Well, I'm talking about before the American ones came out,
right.
The Japanese versions were big. They were big. Right.
Well, you know, the Japanese wasn't the original either. The original was a Korean film by the name of Ringu.
Well, like I said, some of these were going to be Korean. Right. I just said that. And you're like, oh, by the way, that's Korean, not Japanese. I'm sorry. I can't fucking tell the difference. Can you? Koreans are shorter? I don't know.
We're going to go down that road already. No, I can't. Well, I'm not going to get into that.
Travis says, nope. Not going down that road.
Not chasing that stick. My carrot.
Because that's going to come up when it comes to these characters a little bit later, too. Are you seriously going to put 40-plus Japanese people in a movie and expect me to tell them apart?
No. And there's no need to, really. I mean, we're going to...
No, they do something.
We're going to pick out certain characters by what they do more than who they are or what they look like.
Well, but this movie does go out of its way to differentiate what they look like at a certain point.
And how they are as a character.
A lot of Asian movies, especially Japanese movies, will do this, and we'll get into that later. But... Yeah.
Well, don't forget in the 90s from Asia, you've got... The Jet Li, Jackie Chan wave that hit.
Was that Japanese or Chinese?
That was, that's mostly Chinese.
Travis is still playing catch up here because I literally just went, yeah, it's Japanese, but some of it's Korean and to a certain extent Chinese. And he's like, well, here's a Korean movie, here's some Chinese movies. Yeah, I know, I addressed that. Yeah, we got some action comedy from China.
Well, I'm going to tie it into a movie we were talking about today, is it wasn't... a big trend, but a filmmaker that had a lot of movies come out and was popular to an extent was an actor that's in this movie. And Takeshi Kitano, which is his name, and then he goes by Beat Takeshi when he's an actor.
Can I be Beat? What the fuck does that even mean? What does that even mean?
What, his nickname?
Yeah. What is
I interpreted
it. Can I be Beat Strange when I'm in a movie?
Well, he plays a tough guy. He plays kind of a Japanese Clint Eastwood type of character most often.
So Beat,
and
is
he does a lot of
violence?
Like Yakuza or action films, but not like Jet Li, Jackie Chan like action films. More like, you know, like I was gonna say Wesley Snipes, but that's still going more martial arts. It's more like gunplay, kind of more Chow Yun Fat, John Woo style action.
What does that have to do with his name?
Well, Beat.
You're saying it as it's in reference to violence. Okay.
Yeah, there
that's
you
what
go.
I asked. Yeah. All right. So, I'm trying to get us down this path to where we can get into your phase here, but it's really important.
We'll get there naturally.
It's really important that we stress here how popular this movie was among the nerd culture at the time. There were Battle Royale t-shirts and hoodies and posters, and Travis is sitting here wearing one as we speak, all over the Hot Topic stores, the Spencers. Battle Royale, more than... You're gonna get me on this, but I'm trying to think, other than Akira, mm-hmm. I think Battle Royale, as far as feature films, mm-hmm. Because you want to get into anime and start talking about Dragon Ball Z and Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon. That is merch out the ass. Yeah. Hello Kitty. I get that. Feature films from Asia, imported to America.
From this general time frame.
What had more merch than Akira and Battle Royale? I think they were...
Live action from this era, non-anime.
Well, Akira's anime, but it transcends everything. Right. Akira merch was everywhere. It is still to this day everywhere.
Again, anime aside, and we'd have to leave the era and go back to Godzilla.
Right.
You know, as far as Japanese influence.
Right.
That's on a
mainstream
level.
So Battle Royale, as far as the subculture of nerdiness, was huge.
Again, this was pre-onslaught of influence of the creepy ghost films.
Now, my copy that I watched says 2000. Is that when the director's cut?
No, that is when the actual movie was. Okay, so, and we'll get into this more once we get to that part. But there's a lot to talk about in terms of this movie's release or lack thereof. Why, how that went down.
All right,
but the actual official Japanese release. And that's important. The actual official Japanese release was December 16th of 2000.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before that,
mm-hmm.
I would say between 97 and 99, Cartoon Network started a segment called Toonami,
mm-hmm.
where they started playing anime
mm-hmm.
from a studio called Funimation.
Mm-hmm.
And that absolutely blew the doors off and created an entire anime subculture in this country
mm-hmm.
and that to this day has not abated a bit.
Right.
It only seems to ever get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's any smaller.
It's even more widespread and mainstream today.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I think it's only grown all the way to now. So you're talking 20 years mm-hmm. of pervasive or Asian culture just absolutely I'm trying to find words that aren't negative. I don't want to say infesting or polluting or anything like that, but becoming mainstream in this culture. But those horror movies, Ringu, and what was the original name of The Grudge?
I don't remember.
Those were huge. Those absolutely. It seems like these things just build on top. Like just another thing will come over from Asia, and it'll make this thing even bigger and even bigger and even bigger. Well, but Battle Royale was part of that initial wave. I think the fact that it got big over here was because of Toonami and because people started to take a big interest in manga and anime and all things Asian culture, and then we started getting these American home video releases. Because you remember, 2000 was a huge year for DVD. That's when, and back then, this idea of box sets and audio commentaries and behind the scenes stuff, multiple discs,
still relatively new.
Well, but it was huge.
Yeah,
that people were. People,
well, I remember.
Even people who had VHS collections didn't get audio commentaries.
Well, you did near the end. I remember because before I made the full transition to DVD, I was still buying collector's set editions on VHS. I remember I had the Usual Suspects special collector's edition box set.
Another one was.
It had a separate VHS with a full length audio commentary.
Right. Another one that did that was. Natural Born Killers had a real big collection you could buy on VHS.
Yeah.
But this movie came out when people were... And if you were a Laserdisc, if you had the money to... if your household had the money to have Laserdiscs, you had audio commentaries going all the way back as far as, what, the early 90s?
Yeah, because Criterion was, early 90s back doing that kind of stuff already.
But most people didn't have access to that. So audio commentaries and behind-the-scenes videos and deleted scenes... That was a brand new thing in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so they started pumping out these Asian movies into the home video market. We literally went from a rental market to a collector market overnight.
And that's when you first really started to see the rise of a lot of these companies like Anchor Bay, where their niche was catering to these collectors and these extreme fans where they want, you know, the extravagant clamshell case VHS and then it transitioned over to DVD. Do you remember how Anchor Bay had all those really nice, slick, smooth corner clamshell case special collector's edition VHS releases?
Yeah.
You know?
We used to go, do you remember when there was still Borders?
Mm-hmm.
Borders was a big bookstore, but it also did other media as well.
Yeah, in the back, they always had the music and the movies. Yeah,
and they had, for a long time, even Best Buy
mm-hmm.
had these great, like, cult cinema sections mm-hmm. where you could go and find just about anything. And this was, you got to keep in mind, Amazon, while Amazon mm-hmm. started in the mid-90s,
yeah.
people were still real leery yeah. about putting their credit card information
online. They hadn't become Netflix, king of the world yet.
Netflix even existed back then. And we've talked about this before, as a fucking DVD mail service.
Which they still have, but back then that was it.
It was so weird. And so we talked about this on other podcasts, but that was so weird to me that people would send off for DVDs.
It was, but I ate it up. I was like, this is awesome.
And they're just the discs. Like, you're not getting
in the little slick sleeve.
Yeah, you're getting a little slick sleeve. You pop it in, you watch it, you put it back
in.
And
you pray when you get it, it's not busted from shipping because there's no padding at all.
Right, and there's a prepaid mailer to mail it back. And that's so primitive. Thinking back on it, that was so weird.
But at the time, it was revolutionary.
But you weren't buying a ton of stuff from Amazon. No,
it was pre-digital streaming is what it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you also didn't buy a lot of stuff from Amazon.
No.
A lot of this stuff, big box retailers were still a huge thing. So you would go into a Borders or a Best Buy.
Had Blockbusters.
Or well, I was going to say, this yeah. was the death of mom and pop video.
Yeah.
If Blockbuster dealt the killing blow, this DVD
Netflix
market.
Final nail in the coffin.
Well, I actually think, I would argue that Netflix was able to capitalize on the
yeah.
collector market. I don't think that Netflix was a motivator for people to collect.
No, that's true.
To switch to collecting.
Yeah.
But this was that period where we were all building, for the first time, a lot of us. For me, it was the first time
oh, yeah.
I was building home video collections.
Well, funny story real quick. I'll keep it short, but I used to, way back in the day, I used to work for Best Buy. And we had a pretty killer discount as employees, and we'd have two inventories per year. And if we passed the inventory to the store, we got these big bonus checks. Well, more than once, I went through and blew almost my entire bonus check using the discount, employee discount, on. And one or two of them, the first one or two I did was on VHS because DVD wasn't really in yet. So just building up my collection, that's what I spent all my money on. Which is going through like with a shopping cart, just going, I want that one, I want that
you
one.
You guys have to understand, this was during the tech boom.
Oh, yeah.
We all had money, and we all wanted
oh, yeah.
to spend it.
Yep.
And we were spending it primarily on this.
Mm-hmm.
We bought the fuck out of
consuming
movies.
Media like it was going out of style.
And Battle Royale was one of the big ones from that era. And everybody saw it. Everybody loved it. This was a universally revered movie for the underground cinema.
On that note, I need to back this up half a hair, though. Initially, this was not an easy movie for collectors to get. And I think that fed into the interest. And we'll get into this one.
Was this one of the bootlegs around that era? Because
oh,
I
yeah.
remember,
I remember
movies like Versus being bootlegged, Itchy the Killer even. I remember a lot of
yeah,
these.
And that was more distributor... there's a little more to this than it was for those. I mean, the thing is like, there weren't a lot of companies that were actively carrying... There weren't a lot of retailers in the United States that were actively carrying and stocking Asian films. But you could... like, Borders, you could special order. They didn't always have the stuff in stock, but you'd go in their little system and be like, hey, I want this,
well,
and they'd special order it to the store.
You'd run into a lot of problems, and they still have this to this day.
And you got
to
deal with the regions.
You'd end up getting a Region 2 DVD, so a lot of us, myself
and
included...
And the Region 3 or all region players were not nearly as prevalent back then as they are today.
But for those of us that were real collectors, we bought them.
Right.
I had a Region 3 DVD player, so I could get those import collections and still be able to watch my movies.
I knew a few people that actually had a PAL... VHS player.
Wow.
You know, because in Europe and a lot of other countries, they ran on the PAL standard, PAL, versus NTH. It's been so long, I'm trying to remember the exact acronym. NTHC or...
Yeah, I think it's NTHC, but...
Yeah, but that's what the North America... The
THC might just be what we're thinking about.
That's what we were on. but now it's... Because it takes me back... We talked on a previous episode about how I used to get these mail order catalogs, and from essentially these bootleggers that would distribute via mail, you go through their catalog and find the rare gems and shit that you want, and then you'd pay them however much they're asking plus shipping, and they'd ship it out to you, and you get this, you know, recorded VHS with a handwritten label. But that's when, years and years ago, I first came across the Shining documentary behind the scenes shot by his daughter. Now anyone can see it because it's on one or two different Kubrick collections.
Well, honestly, I think we've completely the peak of special features has come and gone. I don't think a lot of people, because like Netflix, why the fuck doesn't Netflix have these features on it? We're talking 2017.
Really should.
We're talking 2017. Mm-hmm. Netflix is the biggest, the absolute biggest media consumption device.
Yeah.
That's a terrible way to word it. More people consume movies on Netflix than any other format, and yet, they have a Disney license. Mm-hmm. Which means they have access to all the companies. Marvel, they have a Marvel license, a Disney license. They've got a huge catalog.
And it can totally be done.
They have a huge catalog, and none of these movies have special features.
And it's not a matter of ability. It can be done, because there are a couple come to mind out there doing it. Shop Factory has their own Roku channel, which is free. They don't have their full catalog on there, but... The movies they have on their streaming that have commentaries that they've done are available there as well. And then Criterion, for the 5 years they were on Hulu, all their movies that commentary had that available as well to stream. And then now that they've moved it over to Filmstruck, they still maintain that. So it's obviously possible. These smaller streaming services are providing that. But so there's got to be something else behind it, either a licensing thing or just they don't want to build that into their budget and pay for it. It's a choice that they're not doing it. It's not that they can't do it, I guess is what I'm saying.
And I think that the fact that it's the choice is that there's no demand for it.
Really, not enough, enough for them to make it worthwhile.
There's not enough people crying about wanting it. That's why I think we've already hit the peak, and we are back in the valley, and nobody really cares about those. Only guys like us really are passionate enough about wanting to hear director commentaries, wanting to see the behind the scenes
extended
stuff.
Versions or director's cuts, all that stuff in the past. Like I said, I always had to go through these bootleggers by mail or at conventions, you know, to find that stuff. I mean, you couldn't go out and buy it legitimately because it wasn't made available.
Right. So there's a lot of people that are like, get the fuck on with it.
Right.
So let's talk about Battle Royale.
Battle Royale. I love this movie.
This is a Travis pick. It is one that there's a lot of movies, gang, where a movie gets so much accolades, and I watch it and I like it. Maybe I'll love it, but I don't really go back to it, and I don't have a passion for it because it's one of those things where it's like, isn't that movie great? Yeah, that movie's great, and I move on. And I watched this movie. When I watched a ton of other movies, this was like my peak of being a crazy movie collector, and I loved it, and I never watched it again. I had only ever seen this movie once.
Yeah.
And watching it again today, I was like, okay, all right. And we watched the director's cut, because the director's cut's on Amazon, so Travis chose to watch the director's cut with his home version, and I'm watching, and it takes a long time for this thing to really get going. Probably 20 minutes or so into the movie before they're out on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
But holy fuck, man! Once they get out there, almost immediately, once they get out there, onto the deserted island.
Oh yeah,
it is so engaging,
and
it is. We talked about earlier. That if Hunger Games was a world building type of series, where it was all about watching, like seeing the world these people lived in, Battle Royale is all about the interpersonal relations, man. The character development,
but it still builds its world so efficiently in the beginning in the backstory. I mean, you know pretty much everything you need to know about what's going on socially in Japan in this universe. I mean, just basically, in the opening credits, they talk about where unemployment is. There's 800,000 unemployed, and this and that, and the economy is crap, and the students, the children, have started to basically throw their hands up saying, we don't give a fuck, we're going to do whatever we want. They no longer respect adults or authority, you know, all this stuff. When we first meet the teacher character played by Beat Takeshi, basically he's sitting there in the front of class reading this note that one of the students wrote in chalk that we can't read because it's in Japanese, but basically the when it puts the subtitle, it basically says, we're taking the day off because we want to. I mean, that was the message from the students, the class as a whole, to the teacher. I mean, this is kind of what it's come to. This is total culture of apathy. Nobody's striving to make anything of themselves anymore, and the whole country's falling apart. You get all this in the opening credits, in the initial 10, 15 minutes of the movie, backstory just through visually what you're seeing and what's happening on screen, and then sort of, you know, just pieces of narration or character dialogue that you put together in your own head to kind of build this world that exists outside of the relative confines of where this film takes place.
So one of the weird things about this movie in particular, mm-hmm. is that it can be summed up, mm-hmm. quicker than probably almost any other movie we'll ever review on this podcast. Mm-hmm. But to actually talk about the movie,
right.
I don't even know how we're going to do it. That's how complex this movie is.
Yeah.
So, real quick,
mm-hmm.
this is Battle Royale.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, one class gets chosen at random.
At random.
Mm-hmm. To go to a deserted island. They get taken to a deserted island by the military. The military drops them on the island, puts a collar around their neck, says, if you don't kill each other, we'll blow your heads up.
You have 3
and
days.
And then, uh-huh. they all kill each other.
Right.
The end.
The end.
This is a movie about kids,
mm-hmm.
a class, students, all in the same class.
Yep.
They get kidnapped by the military,
mm-hmm.
put on an island,
mm-hmm.
and kill each other.
And they're not randomly.
And that's exactly what happens.
They're not randomly selected students from all over the country. It's just one class. So you got friends in there, you got enemies, you got boyfriends, girlfriends, you got brothers, sisters, maybe, who knows?
Let me see if I can say. Let me see if I can surmise this movie even faster. One class a year gets picked by the military to go to a desert island and kill each other.
Yep.
You can tell this story in, what was that, 10 words?
Yeah.
And yet the movie is such a rich, complex, so many layers of social commentary. There's so much drama and anticipation, anxiety, horror, fear.
Interpersonal relationships that are dealt with.
In a way that, another way to describe this movie is, this is the Japanese version of Lord of the Flies. And yet, I think that while Lord of the Flies was a character-driven story, mm-hmm. you very much feel compassion for mm-hmm. those characters. Man, these kids. These fucking kids.
For the most part, are shitheads. Yeah.
It is a... it's a crazy movie. So, let's get into the numbers.
Okay. We'll talk numbers and we'll talk good stuff here. Rotten Tomatoes is 87%.
87% of Rotten Tomatoes. See, this is one of those things where it's like, I know it's a good movie, therefore, I don't know why I like bad movies. I'm always the champion of these crappy movies that I think deserve way more than they get credit for. And then a movie like Battle Royale, I'm like, yeah, everybody already likes it. What do I have? So what am I going to add to this that everybody else doesn't already say?
Yeah.
I'm a champion for the underdog.
No, I hear you. And for
however, it is a cult movie. Yeah, there's no denying. Like I said, the merch for this movie alone mm-hmm. was fucking huge. To this day, you see people walking around in Battle Royale shirts. Like I said, when The Hunger Games came out, nobody would shut the fuck up about Battle Royale.
No, but for a while, though, this movie was not like that. And that's the thing. Now, this is... I think it's one of the top 10 grossing films in Japan of all time.
Holy shit.
Yeah. One of the top 10 highest grossing films in Japan.
So this is a blockbuster.
In Japan, yes. Not here. Takes a certain type of person to appreciate this film here. Let me give a little bit of the backstory.
Yeah, because we're going to talk about that later as the film ends, and I'm going, what the fuck?
So it's 114 minutes. About 113 minutes is the theatrical cut. Now, it's not really a director's cut. Myself, I fall into that trap, and a lot of people refer to it as that. It's not really, it's an extended cut. It's not really a director-approved director's cut. That cut, it's really only about 8 minutes difference. It's 121 minutes. But it was released in December 16th of 2000 in Japan. It's only played on opening weekend about 13 screens in Japan and made 67,500 yen. Anyway, it's about 605,000 US dollars if we translate it, okay? Domestic in Japan, it's grossed in US dollars 25 million plus at this point. Now, technically, if we give it an actual US release date, was in basically a year later. You know, this movie first hit a theater in the US on December 24th of 2011. On Christmas Eve.
2011?
Yeah.
Or
2001? No, 2011.
You said a year later.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant not a year later. I meant...
a decade later.
Yeah, a decade later. But here's the thing. Other than occasional festival circuits, this film went 11 years before it got any U.S. or Canadian distribution. Interested in venturing a guess as to what may have... what at least one of the popular theories as to what was behind that.
What kept it out of the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Other than the blatant pedophilia?
Well, that's only in the extended cut, though. That doesn't show up in the theatrical version.
Okay.
But that's one of
the Requiem 3 doesn't show up
for, in the... No, none of the Requiems. None of the three Requiems are in the theatrical version. One of my favorite parts of the extended cut actually is the backstory of Mitsuko, where you get a sense of why she's so fucked up in the head. And she's one of the best characters in the movie. What happened in 1999 in the U.S.?
99 was that Columbine?
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't want to put it here.
Everybody had cold feet.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Because, I mean,
so
this is a movie about high school kids or junior high students killing each other.
Yeah. You know? So anybody that lives on the moon and doesn't know what Columbine is, two kids walked into a high school and mowed down. How many people did they kill? Lots?
A lot.
Lots of kids. Injured even more.
Oh, yeah.
And then killed themselves. Ended up having, like, manifestos.
And then sadly sparked however many copycats, you know?
Yeah, happens all the time.
Yeah.
To this day, there's still copycats that still walk in and murder their...
So, yeah, understandably, you could see why distributors and in studios and theater owners were nervous.
For some reason, I know the exact day. It was April 20th, 1999.
Yep.
That's also Hitler's birthday, which only makes me look even more racist.
I swear.
Look, 420 has a lot of connotations. It's the day all stoners celebrate as a holiday. And so there's always memes of Hitler and weed. And then I also associate Columbine with that day because that's an infamous day that happened on. So all those things. I don't fucking care that it's Hitler's birthday. It's just something that always gets brought up on the internet.
But see, that carried over to the home video market as well, because during that same 11 years, not only was it virtually impossible to see it in the theater in the West, but you could only see it via bootleg or region-free DVDs.
Travis imports. Brings all this fantastic knowledge to the podcast. I talk about Hitler's birthday.
And you're dead on. I just double-checked it. April 20th, 1999. You are amazing, sir.
Yeah,
<right. laughs> So let's just say, okay, but see, even if you... take that. Say Columbine shooting never happened, okay? And let's just say it got a release. It still had so much... It had its work cut out for it because I'm going to go through just the 8 top films that weekend that were playing here, okay? You got Cast Away.
That's the Tom Hanks crazy,
right.
crazy popular
Wilson!
Crazy popular movie.
What Women Want. Which was way more popular than I think it should have been. How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Wait a minute, was that Mel Gibson
who
could hear the
Helen
thoughts
Hunt.
Of women?
Yeah.
Fuck.
And then, remember, this is Christmas Eve. This is Christmas weekend. Okay, right? Then you got How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the live-action Jim Carrey version of the Doctor Seuss classic.
I'm trying to forget that.
Then you got another Christmas movie, which is the kind of batshit crazy Nicolas Cage Family Man. Then you got Sandra Bullock, who, for whatever reason, always her movies make a ton of money. You got Miss Congeniality, where she's like the undercover cop that's got to be like a fashion model or runway model or something, wasn't that? She was like a Miss USA or something like that. Then you've got a Disney, no, not Disney, one of the other competitors, The Emperor's New Groove. You got a major feature-length animated movie. Then you got Vertical Limit, which I think that was it skydiving or mountain climbing? One of those kind of extreme sports kind of action movies. And then number 8, you've got Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon still hanging on there, because that was a big moneymaker too.
Huge.
So right there, I mean, even at the number 8 slot, you've got a bigger, more recognizable Asian film that you're competing with in the U.S.
Right.
So yeah, it would have had a hard go even if it had gotten distribution in a timely fashion.
As an ultra-violent fucking dystopian science fiction movie. Yeah.
So the film
But boy, did we love it. Video Store Kids fucking ate this movie the fuck up.
Yep.
All had our bootleg versions of this fucking thing.
Yep. And I remember there's a toy show here in town that I go to every once in a while, and there's always at least a few guys that still have some of the what's left anyway of the rare, hard to find stuff or out of print stuff. And it's fun just to see what kind of rare gems you can find, just because, look, I'm not a supporter of bootlegging, but I am a supporter of, if something's not made available and you can't go out and buy it legitimately, I have no problem with a person going out and buying a bootleg, because if they're not going to make it available for you to buy legally, I know the artist wants it out there, so you're not going to hurt their feelings.
One of my friends out on the convention circuit, he's got a bootleg table that he does, and it's he's got like he tries to do it real ethically, where he only puts stuff out that's out of print. So if it's in print, he takes it off the table. Right. If it's out of print, he keeps it on the table. And so he's got a lot of great stuff, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of out of print titles. I've never felt bad buying one from him.
Yeah,
because they're not available.
I do that with
if the companies wanted to make money on them, they keep them in print.
Right.
They don't make enough money to bother keeping in print. Mm. So why not let
it's these the guys that sell first the run secondary stuff market. That's currently in the theaters,
right,
and they sell
bootleg
DVDs like for $5-$10 a piece. I'm like, man, whatever.
The new Fast and the Furious on the weekend that comes out on a crappy Asian camcorder with subtitles. Like, I'm not into that.
No,
I'm not into
you.
That at all. Anyway.
Yeah, so not a whole lot of... So I don't really have a lot of numbers to give us for U.S. because there really weren't any to speak of. But it was a huge film in Japan. But not without its controversy. Do we want to talk a little about the controversy before we go on?
Considering I don't know how the fuck we're going to talk about the movie itself in any great capacity, let's talk about as much as we can, sir.
So Kenji Fukasaku is the director.
Made a lot of movies.
He was 70 years old. He turned 70 during production of this movie.
Spoiler alert, didn't he actually die on the set of Battle Royale 2?
Yes, he died during production of the sequel, Battle Royale 2 Requiem, and his son, Kenta Fukasaku, took over and finished the sequel. The other thing that's important to know is Kenta, being Kenji's son, also wrote the screenplay of Battle Royale. I assume Battle Royale 2, but I don't recall. I'm sure he did.
So the son wrote the screenplay.
Which is based on a novel by another author.
Japanese novel?
Kushin Takami, yeah.
Was it a novel or was it a manga?
It was a novel.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. That was
I didn't know Japanese people wrote books. I don't put myself
over. Oh, what's that I hear? Your inbox blowing up?
I don't put myself in a very good light on this podcast, folks.
People of a certain age, like our age and younger, are probably not going to know this reference, but the reason Kenji Fukusaku...
You're going to be doing that a lot, man. if you're gonna blah, blah, blah after every time you fuck up one of these names, we're in for a long night.
He probably is best known here for a movie called Tora, Tora, Tora. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah,
it's a World War II era war film. That's what he's best known for. But you would think watching this movie, it's done by some hip, younger 20s, 30s. No, this guy was 70 years old when he made Battle Royale. You know, so you look at it from that perspective, and it helps you kind of understand what they're doing with the movie, because it's not a peer, it's someone of age, of wisdom, that's looking on society saying, okay.
How old was his son, though, when he wrote it?
That I don't know.
Was his son a teenager?
No, his son didn't write it. His son adapted the screenplay. He didn't write the novel.
Yeah, but how old was he when he... Well, never mind, because it's going to take you 20 minutes to look it up. It doesn't matter. I was just going to say, he was older when he directed it, but his son was probably younger when he wrote it, and that's what allows it to have such an authentic youth.
The son was only born in 72.
The youth in the film feel very authentic. These don't feel like old people writing young people roles. And the actors themselves are young. The actors don't seem like older people playing younger
people. Yeah, the actors in this film that played the students range from 15 to 25 in real age. I was just... When I first realized who it actually was, not necessarily his filmography, he's got a lot of films out there he did, but the fact that this is a 70-year-old man that saw this and said, this needs to be made, and in the perspective in which he made it, that was pretty impressive to me.
It's a complex film with a ton of practical effects.
Oh, absolutely.
Almost all done outdoors. Like, there's a lot that goes into making a movie like
that. Well, the Japanese parliament attempted unsuccessfully to get both the novel as well as the movie banned. They never succeeded, but they attempted more than once, both on the novel and the movie, to get it banned. They said it was unfit and it was harmful to youth, and that they didn't get the story, what was trying to be done with it. And from my understanding, they felt it was just glorified violence.
I'll tell you what, man. Watching this movie today, that shit doesn't feel glorifying to me. It's very tragic.
It is.
This is a tragic movie, and it serves exactly its purpose. Mm-hmm. It shows the horror of war.
Oh yeah.
Its subtext is showing you the horror of innocent children, which is what you would consider to be the type of boy that would enlist young into the military and end up in these horrific situations.
Right.
And that's the allegory, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different allegories. There's a lot of layers to it. There's an allegory of social acceptance and what it means to have friends and trust at that age when we're learning, when you're first learning about trust, when you're first learning about love, when you're first learning about betrayal and heartbreak, and everyone's murdering each other at the same time, it's brilliant. Like, how many different layers can you peel off of this?
Well, one of the things that a lot of people...
But I don't think glory is any... Never at any point feels to me like anybody in this movie is happy. But there are sadistic characters that are taking pleasure in what they're doing, but they aren't ever shown in a positive light.
Yeah, and they're a minority.
And they aren't shown in a positive light. The things they do aren't cool.
Right.
The things they do are sadistic and horrific.
Well, what I find interesting is that there's been a number of people I've talked to over the years that don't like or that dislike this movie. And when I, other than just on a fundamental basis of it's violent, I don't like violence, those people aside, okay, the people that watch it and appreciate it for what it is, so to speak, but then still they don't care for the movie, they dislike it, and I ask them why they dislike it, more often than not, those people tell me that they think the melodrama is too much, it's cheesy, it's over the top. I said, but that's the point. You've got a movie that's about that age group, junior high to high school age students, that are dealing with all this shit on top of...
You're talking about people that come from the fucking video game generation. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, you take a group of fucking high school kids, you throw them out on an island and tell them, if you don't kill each other, we're going to blow your head up. They're going to freak out.
Yep.
And they're going to continuously freak out. And when it's all over with, they ain't going to be okay. Do you remember one of the last lines? What was one of those last lines? I forget the exact quote. The kid's laying, the survivor from the previous games, he's laying in the back, and he calls out to the kid that's driving, and he says something to the effect of, this is going to be really hard.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the emotional impact that what he just went through, because he's lived it before.
Because he's a survivor. He's won a previous one.
He's telling him this isn't going to be easy.
Right.
And he's not talking about the boat ride to the mainland.
Right.
He's talking about living with the massacre just happened.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, because that kid came back and volunteered to play again.
And that happened. There's a reason for that in the Hunger Games too. And so there are a lot of reasons why people said, "Hey, this Hunger Games thing." What's kind of funny is the younger people would say,
"This Battle Royale, that's a ripoff of Hunger Games." I'm like, "Son, read." But no, but the melodrama is so crucial. I mean, it has to be there because you've got this age group, and they're dealing with all this stuff, you know, puberty and all this hormones and. And love and friendship and all this stuff, right? And then all this other stuff piled on top of it. You're gonna have it. You have to have it. You know, that's why all these CW shows are so melodramatic, because they're dealing with that period of life where everything's a fucking melodrama.
You know? Now, I was gonna ask you this: the cutaway scenes, the scenes to them playing basketball, the scenes to them of them hanging out and being friends or flirting with each other. That take place a lot of times either just before or just after these horrific murders. Are those all part of the...
Those are part of the extended cut.
Are the extended cut?
Yeah.
Are none of them in the theatrical release?
To be specific, the extended cut includes the basketball game flashbacks are all part of the extended cut. The three Requiem epilogues, as we talked about. There's additional shots of the lighthouse after the shootout that were added in. Additional reaction shots in the classroom prior to them going out. And then just various extensions to existing shots and then some added CGI.
So if people watched the theatrical version...
They wouldn't have gotten as much of the backstory.
They really would have had a problem with the extended version and the melodrama that they add with the...
Oh, yeah.
With the flashbacks to them being students.
Yeah. But that's only if they don't understand what it is that they're watching, you know. Because, again, it's crucial. I mean, when it's all said and done, I classify this, like I mentioned before, this sort of what I call social science fiction. I put this right up there with A Clockwork Orange as far as the type of movie it is. And coincidentally, that film also went through a lot of a very similar type of attempted censorship and criticism that this movie did.
I would say Peckinpah's Straw Dogs, and I think I mentioned that on this
podcast. Wild Bunch, even.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways, and most of them have been done.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of ways that you can tell very poignant social stories by using ultraviolence. There really are. And for people that just say, "I won't watch anything that's violent because it's stupid," it's the same type of people that won't watch horror movies because they think that that horror is somehow, it's impossible for horror to be deep or layered or
argument.
Yeah, and absolutely. And this is one of those films that has so much social commentary, so many layers of social commentary, that dismissing it outright for ultraviolence is totally missing the point.
Okay.
What now? Answer me this: do you know if the novel had this type of ultraviolence in it?
I'm assuming so, but I can't say for certain because I've not read it.
Because you know, if you read Lovecraft and then you watch the Stuart Gordon movies, or people that watch the Stuart Gordon movies like Reanimator and From Beyond, and have never read the stories, would assume that Lovecraft was this like Schlockmeister who had tons of tits of gore and stuff, but the tits and gore were actually added thematically,
make it more palatable for modern audiences.
So I'm wondering, was the novel sort of a social commentary on the horrors of war and the struggles of youth, or was it also ultraviolent? Did the ultraviolence get added for cinema, or was that part of the original story?
That I don't know. You make me want to go out and try and find a copy of the
encyclopedia fails me again. I'm just playing.
Well, let's talk about the violence for a minute, because it's such an integral part of the movie. But so it is a very violent film. However,
talking about the heads flying through windows with grenades in their mouths.
That was a cool shot.
Talking about a group of girls poisoning each other, getting paranoid about who did it, and then murdering each other with fucking submachine guns.
Well, the irony of that is this girl's torture. So each student, when they leave, they're given a bag with a mystery weapon. They don't know what they get. Some are good. Most are fair. Some are worthless.
Two of the main characters get a pot lid. And a pair of binoculars.
Right. One person gets a tracking device.
Which that's a really useful. Cool one. That's a cool one.
One I would mind that one. Of course,
the taser sucks, but I could figure out a way to fashion that taser on the end of a stick and turn it into like a fucking stabbing.
One girl gets a bottle of poison.
There's a lot of guns, though.
Right.
A lot of them get guns.
Well, so she's with this group that are kind of hiding out. There's like five or six of them, right? And she's like, I got to poison everyone, but I'm tore up about it. I can't do it. So she puts the poison in this one chick's food. Or no, she puts the poison in the food she's going to take to the one guy that's there in bed recovering. But before she can do that, this other chick rolls in and takes the plate out of her. She's so hungry, takes the plate, starts eating it. She starts losing her shit. She's like, oh my God, she's going to die right here.
Yeah, I don't think she was going to kill everybody. I think she just wanted to kill the dude so all the girls could still be
right. Group. Well, okay, yeah. And then when she dies, they all get paranoid, start flipping out, and they blow each other away, except for the girl that had the poison to begin with.
And those are the kind of kills that this movie presents. These are kind of horrific scenarios. There's a scene with a kid that runs in and he's trying to save a girl and she fucking mows him down with a fucking machine gun, and he's laying there going, hurry up and leave, because they're gonna come for you, they're gonna hear the gunshots. Mm-hmm. She's going, why the fuck are you telling me that? And he's going, because I love you. And she's going, you love me, you never talk to me. And he's like, your smile, you're so cute. And she's going, what the fuck, what am I supposed to, and he dies. She's like, what the fuck am I supposed to do now? Another girl walks up behind her and goes, die, and shoots her to death.
No, she says, die, comma, ugly.
Oh, no, she says die ugly to a different girl. She says die ugly to a girl, and that's then the teacher shows up.
Yeah.
The teacher shows up and she runs off.
Mitsuko. Oh.
Talk
She's
about
a
it.
Character. Okay. Mitsuko, you learn very quickly she's not all there. She's kind of got sociopathic, psychopathic tendencies. She's grinning ear to ear. She's loving this. She gets a weapon of a sickle.
Is our first introduction to her when the other girl with the taser runs into the room? She's like, oh, hey,
the release to go fight, yeah.
Yeah, I just, and she's like trying to be all nice to this girl. Like, oh, all you got was that? That's cool. And then she fucking takes it from her and tries to fucking taser. The girl runs around and tries to, and you learn, like, she's into this.
Oh, yeah. She's into this. And you learn a little bit about why she is the way she is with the flashback.
Which happens way later, right as she dies.
Right, after you see her fuck up.
Right before she dies, actually. I think, isn't it right after that scene where she says die and shoots the girl to death?
Don't
we get her flashback right after that?
I think so, yeah. It's before she dies, though. But you remember her death scene?
Yeah.
She's in the arms she'd been shot. She's in the arms of one of the guys. And one of her lines I remember is, oh, God, just one more thing. You know, she says, oh, God, can I tell him just one more thing? And looks up and says, you're so cool. And then dies.
That's not the crazy girl.
It's not?
No, the crazy girl, she fights exchange student.
That's right.
And she tries to sickle him.
That's right.
And he's wearing the bulletproof vest.
Yeah, and he mows him. That's a different girl. That's right. Okay. Yeah, because the dude with the fully automatic machine gun with the crazy spiky hair, which the villains in both anime and live action, a lot of these Japanese films always had that similar kind of hair. If you notice.
Well, I was going to get into that a little bit because it is totally racist to say this. I don't care because it's true. It's honest. It's scientific. Japanese people have very, very narrow genetic code. They all look very, very similar to each other.
The Japanese
know this, and they do things in their films to differentiate different characters. When there's a large cast, you'll notice that there are characters in this movie that wear particular types of head scarves, or they get wrapped up with medical tape to differentiate them. These are the main characters. So you've got the exchange student. He's the only character that's not in a
uniform.
He's wearing all black, and he's got big, spiky, blonde hair that's unnaturally dyed blonde. Why? Because they want you to see that he's different.
Yeah.
The reason they put the main, you know, two of the main characters, one of the guys, the survivor from the previous...
I mean, they've obviously set him up as an exterminator.
The survivor from the previous year's game... He wears a cloth bandana
kind of
Rambo
style, yeah.
And the guy that he's saving, he gets all wrapped up in medical bandages kind of early on. He's got one on his head, and so you can tell. And who are we talking about? What was her name? The crazy girl with
Mitsuko.
The sickle, Mitsuko. She takes off her She takes off her over her top and just has a plain white top on, and she's differentiated from the rest of the characters. So it's sure, call me a racist for saying it, but the Japanese even go out of their way to try to style their characters as differently as they can to make sure you know who's who when their facial features are very similar to each other.
Well,
they all have brown eyes and black hair. It's not racist to say that. It just is.
Well, since
they all have brown eyes, black hair, and little faces, little tiny faces.
Since we're on the PC topic, I'm going to take it a step further. So there's no black characters in the movie. It's a Japanese film, okay? But right out the gate, as soon as the battle begins, do you remember what happens?
That would it have to do with race? No.
Well, not race. But, well, technically the first kill, you see a chick walk up with a crossbow bolt through her neck, right?
Right.
As one of the guys...
I remember the fat kid comes
the fat kid down. Is the second kid to go.
Oh, that's what you're saying. You're saying this movie's prejudiced against fat people? Because he's the only fat character?
Out of 42 students, there's one fat kid and he's the second one to go.
I mean, in a survival situation, the fat kid ain't going to last long. Unless you're on in Lost, then the what is his name?
Hurley.
Hurley. Yeah, he never stops. He never stops being fat. They're on an island scavenging for food. He never stops being fat.
Gilligan's Island scenarios.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. So we'll talk about the violence a little more because there's a lot of it here, and it's great. It's so well done. It's well choreographed. It's realistic. It's high energy. High impact, emotional, but none of it's over the top or glorified or fantasy like. Or it's sloppy. It's well choreographed sloppy action.
Tarantino-ish,
which I'll come back to that here in a minute. But what's great is it feels like this is how this shit would actually go down. It's not like watching some high production, you know, like. Unrealistic fight scenes, right? These are sloppy fights. These are deaths by accident. These are just, I'm going to spray a whole magazine to kill one person.
A lot of bullets fired.
Now, with that said, all the controversy about the violence, it's not a gory movie. Why? When people get shot, and I'm talking about not just once in most cases, people are just riddled with bullets. You get a lot of blood stains. Very, very few bullet holes. Okay? Only two characters, one of the male students, and then at the end when the teacher gets his, are the only two times that you see actual bullet holes. Otherwise, it's just blood stains appear.
You see a lot of slit throats.
You do see slit throats.
Spraying blood.
But it's a lot more death by bullets than anything else. Primarily, one of the main reasons is because you've got this one psychopath character, the transfer student with the blonde spiky hair. He's got I don't know how many clips he must have, but he's got a fully automatic machine. He's just wandering around the island just blowing people
to pieces. He never runs out. When he gets shot... No, he's not... Wait, how the fuck does he die? How do they kill him?
After he gets to the place where they're building the bomb, and the kid gets shot that came up with the idea, and then he sets off the bomb.
Yeah, he goes blind.
And they
explode. That's fucking badass.
And then the other transfer student ends up shooting him and killing him because he can't see. Because
he can't see. And he's still firing off fucking
He's
clips.
Still shooting blindly.
Well, he's fucking blind. Woo. Yeah, but, they color his eyes over.
Right.
And he's got like blood, like dried blood.
But see,
blood
even when they get
eyes.
Their throats slit, you really don't see any makeup effects in terms of gore. You just see blood. So I find that an interesting dichotomy that a lot of people criticize this for being so violent and gory, but it's to a great extent, it's very much like late 50s, early 60s Westerns. It's implied violence in the sense that you see blood stains come in on the clothing.
One thing that this movie does lack is it does lack amputation.
Except for the severed head with the grenade in.
Not a lot of people getting their arms and legs cut off.
No, and just because I think the main reason for that is that would be glorifying violence because, I mean, it's not, but I mean in the sense that the point is to kill each other, it's pointless to go hacking off limbs because that's not necessarily going to kill them. And I think Whereas in other types of movies, it's like we just like to see it because it's cool.
And fascinated by Travis's kill logic. He's like putting himself in this scenario going, I'm not going to cut off your arm. I'm just going to fucking shoot you.
Yeah.
I want you to be dead. I don't want you to walk around.
Quick and efficient.
If you walk around with one arm, you might kill me with that other arm.
Another behind the scenes interesting aspect of this, the violence in the movie, though, is that all of the actors did their own stunts.
Oh, wow. There's no stunt people in this movie?
No, they all did their own stunts. When they first announced and started planning for this film, 6,000 young actors auditioned to be in this movie.
Wow.
The initial process of elimination narrowed it down to 800 finalists.
Oh, my God.
800 finalists. Okay, it gets better. These 800 finalists went through a six-month physical fitness training under the director's own supervision.
But that fat kid hated it.
He made the cut, though. If he did, was the second one to die. That was his little plug for being healthy. Be healthier, you could die. You'd be the first one to go. So I have to give these young actors credit. I mean, just they did all their own stunts. They went through hell just to get the role. And then I think it helped in pulling off the violence in the sense that it seemed realistic. Even if visually, like, the gore factor was underplayed, and I think intentionally, because if they made it extra gory on top of everything else, it would have just garnered more controversy. But how the characters interacted and the kills and the violence played out felt very real in terms of how the interactions between the characters occurred on screen. I think that plays a lot in how successful the movie was.
This could have very easily been a slasher, boring, through the paces, one kill after another after another after another. But what's so good about this movie, and it had me sitting and thinking, I posted this on social media earlier, it had me thinking about the different social groups I've been a part of and which ones would go psycho immediately, which ones wouldn't be able to handle it at all. This movie, one of the things that I walk away from is that every personality type is represented in these kids. You get the kids that want to stick together. You get the kids that, like the hacker kids, that they figured out they're going to make a fucking bomb. They're going to disable the collars from being able to blow them up, and they're going to drive a bomb to the school and kill the army.
And then you got
they're going to save everybody.
Yep. And then you got the two girls that are just naive.
That are like, hey everybody,
hey on a bullhorn, hey everybody, meet us up here. We're going to resist this. We're not going to kill each other. Let's just all be peaceful. And then
you remember what the fucking transfer kid does to him?
He blows him away.
He mows him down, but one of them doesn't die right away. And he walks over with the bullhorn, and he turns it on, and they can hear her
kind of wailing. Holds it up to her, and kind of squealing.
And then he shoots her and kills her while she's screaming into the bullhorn. That's fucking vicious.
He's fucking.
So they run the gamut from vicious to our main characters who are, remember that the main character only kills one guy, and it's because they tumble down a hill together, and the kid has a hatchet in his hand, and he ends up hatcheting himself in the head.
It was an accident.
Yeah, because he hatchets himself in the head.
Right.
And then I guess he kills the transfer student at the end.
Yeah. And then you've got the Romeo and Juliet couple.
Oh, and he kills the teacher. Or does the survivor from the previous year kill the transfer kid?
No. Because
is that his first
kill? That's when the main character, the of the two, not the transfer student, but the other boy, because he's kind of a weakling, and he says so himself at one point. That's when his balls finally drop. And he basically says, screw this, and he blows the teacher away.
So he didn't kill the blind
top
transfer.
Top 10 best death scenes of all of cinematic history.
Hated it. Absolutely hated it.
You hated it?
Hated it. Stupidest, cheesiest, fucking dumbest thing, but you think Blind Fury is a great movie. So your sense of humor is a little... Your sense of humor skews towards the fucking... the Three Stooges area. Mine doesn't. But anyway, so it's the survivor from the previous... The Rambo head guy that kills the blind transfer student.
Yes.
So then the only legit kill that our main character gets is the teacher at the end.
Yes.
So he's a complete pacifist throughout this entire thing. So we have a range of personality types.
Even though he vowed to protect the girl.
From sadistic murderer to pacifist, and everything in between. And these kids are all creating these different, very much like the Survivor reality show, they're creating these different allegiances with each other and pacts with each other.
Well, at one point you've got the Romeo and Juliet couple that are like, we can't do this, so let's kill ourselves. They kill and they both jump off a cliff together.
Do they jump off a cliff, or do they hang, they hang each other? They hang themselves.
No, they jump off a cliff.
What about the couple that was hanging? When the psycho girl first runs into the girl with the taser.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a different couple, because these two actually jump off the cliff into the
rocky. There's multiple couples that that kill themselves.
It's just, we don't see, the couple of hanging themselves, we don't see them do that. That's an afterthought.
So that's one of the things that I loved about this, was it wasn't just a paint-by-numbers, random kill, one after the other after the other. It's a really well-written melodrama.
I mean, even Mitsuko, she's part of sort of like, well, I guess we could call the popular cheer girl, cheerleader girl clique. And so at one point she runs into another one from that clique, and then they get into it because apparently she stole the boyfriend from this other one.
Well, she tries to play, she's such a psycho, she tries to play it off, starts crying, begging for her life.
That's a good fight scene.
Ends up grabbing the taser where the other girl doesn't see it, tases the gun out of her hand, and is like, fuck you, bitch, and fucking shoots her. Cold blood. And there's so many scenes like that. There's so almost, I can't really, honestly, I can't really think of any of the kills that don't have a ton of thought put into them that aren't worth watching.
Absolutely.
And you're talking about 40 plus people that die in this movie.
This is like, if this is like teenage soap opera to the max. You know, it's like, it's all there, but done in an entertaining fashion, in a thoughtful way.
I can't think of any kills that are just throwaway, that just don't mean anything. Every one of them has meaning to it, and
it's again, not just
there,
the kill.
There are people that flip out. There are people that are that like the survivor from the previous year. Mm-hmm. He kills, but he only kills in self defense.
Right,
he'll kill anybody if they're trying to hurt him. Yep. But he's an honorable man. He won't. He's not there to kill people. Right. He's there to survive. And you can. This isn't the type of game where there's only one survivor.
To keep it Japanese, you can say he's the samurai versus the other guy with the spiky blonde hair is more like a ninja, rogue ninja. You know,
whatever works. You know. Whatever works. So, are there any other scenes that you want to address before we move? Because I want to talk about the ending, and I want to talk about the requiems, and I want to get the fuck out of here. Because we managed to do a really good episode.
Oh yeah.
That I didn't think we were going to be able to pull off, because this is such a complex movie.
Well, there's one thing I want to add real quick about the director. I find him fascinating after having researched this movie. At one point during the heat of the controversy, he gave a press conference. And the press conference was directed towards the age group of the film's characters. Okay, that teenage, junior high to teenage high school age group, right? And during his press conference, he was quoted as saying, "You can sneak in, and I encourage you to do so."
Wow.
Because they were being told, "You're not to see this movie, because it's damaging to youth." The 70-year-old filmmaker was encouraging young teenagers who were specifically being told by authorities, by parliament, not to see the film.
That's probably why it made so much
to
money.
To go see it, right?
They kept telling people not to.
But we won't get in, I guess, to the death scene of B. Takeshi, the teacher.
No, I want to.
You want to?
Okay. Absolutely.
Well, one thing I want to talk about, because I'm fascinated.
What are things other than that?
Yeah, yeah.
Things other than that you still want to touch on?
The bulk of the movie, okay, so I love, possibly one of my favorite parts of the movie is in the classroom once they arrive.
Oh, another thing. I fucking fast forwarded to that. It goes on so long.
Before we get to that, actually, one thing I want to talk about is, just briefly, is what's interesting is none of these students have any idea what's happening. They're basically under the impression they're going on a class trip.
They go into a cave, like a covered tunnel. And when they wake up...
Yep. Well, they gas them in the bus. And then they wake up, they're in this classroom that they're not familiar with.
With the
and one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he's talking to him, explaining to him what's happening. And this is one of the teachers from the school they were selected from. He's basically explaining, he's like, he puts BR in that a Japanese character. And it's basically the stands for Battle Royale something. And it's basically says, do you guys know this law? And it was just like blank. He's like, oh, well, that's unfortunate. And what he's talking about is, he's making a point there. It's like, these kids, not only do they not know where they're at or what's going on, they're not even aware of the law that mandates this happens.
Right.
That's how out of touch,
right,
and apathetic the youth of the country in this hypothetical future Japan has become. They don't even know that it's possible this could happen.
And they have like a classroom tutorial that they put on like a VHS player.
What's the typical high pitch? What would you call that? The typical type of Japanese girl character?
A commercial, you know? Girl.
Yeah, but just super cute, high pitched, yeah, bubbly. You know,
she's explaining the rules to everybody, and that's all good. And there's one girl that she's mouthing off, so the teacher fucking throws a knife into her forehead.
Square in her forehead.
Murders her.
And then his response is, I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to.
I'm not supposed to do that. And then another kid, he flips out, so they blow his head up.
Yeah, he triggers his sensor in his necklace.
But the part that I fast-forwarded was they ended up, did they go through everybody? They like call everybody's name. If they don't go through everybody, they're telling you who everybody is, right. And I get that. These are the characters that are going to be most important. So they're telling you their name and associating their face with them as they all run out the door and get their packs with their special weapon in it. But to me, that got really redundant. Yeah. So after a few minutes, I was like, all right, I'm just gonna, I don't care. Yeah. I'm going to fast forward. And then I complain that I don't know who anybody is. I fast forward through the scene where they tell me who everybody is and then complain that they all look alike and they're Japanese.
Real quick before we move on, there's one thing I want to go over just briefly in terms of the rules, because we kind of glossed over that a little bit.
Thanks. So, way late for that. Go right
ahead. But basically, they have 3 days. They're supposed to all kill each other until there's one left standing.
Hour and 20 minutes of this podcast, Travis wants to let you know what it's about.
But added to that, they have danger zones to where he gives the locations and the times. And if you're in that danger zone when the time hits, your neck bomb will basically go off. Your
collar goes off.
Right. And if there's more than one left alive at the end of the 3 days, then they just kill everybody. And so there's really technically not supposed to be any out. Now, of course, in watching the movie, you find out that certain students develop a loophole, so to speak, which is why we end up with 3 students leaving the island rather than just one.
Well, because the Rambo...
Spoiler.
The Rambo... hour and 20 minutes in this thing, it ain't a spoiler anymore. So the Rambo character, the samurai character... He pretends to kill the other two survivors. And so the teacher, he sends the military away, and it's just him by himself. Mm-hmm. The kid walks out of the deserted island jungle, mm-hmm. and he and the teacher sit and talk. The teacher figures out that he's disabled his collar somehow, mm-hmm. and that he's the person actually that had the plans or the virus or whatever it was, not the tech kids that were going to use the bomb to blow up the school. Right. He actually gave it to them. He was the mole.
The mastermind,
So the teacher pulls out his gun and he's going to kill him, but the other two survivors are pacifist character and the girl that survives with him. And is that the girl that poisoned everybody?
I don't think so. I think it's a different girl.
Yeah, I have no idea. I fast forwarded through that part. So they walk in. They walk in, and no, that's what I mean. I fast forwarded through the part that they introduced everybody. So I don't get to know who people are. So they walk in, and he's basically like, "Oh, you guys fucked up." But then the movie takes its final turn, and I thought it was retarded. Personally, Travis, I guess, liked it. The teacher walks over, and he's got this mural set up that he's drawn. He's painted, I guess, and he pulls.
That was actually painted by the actor himself.
Well, good for him. he yanks the cloth off of it, and it's all the dead kids on the island. It's a caricature of all these dead kids with the surviving girl in the middle, and he sort of pledges his love to the girl because he's got a kid at home, and there's several times throughout the movie the kid calls him and yells at him, tells him he's a piece of shit. And so he basically goes, I don't want to live anymore. I have nothing to go home to. My kid hates me.
Right.
I'd rather die at your hands than live any longer.
Right.
Okay. Whatever. So she lifts her gun, and he's going, if you don't kill me, I'll kill you. And he goes to lift his gun, and now our pacifist character.
Because he vowed to protect Nagakura or whatever her name is.
Whatever.
Naga something.
He lifts his machine gun, and he mows down the teacher. And they're all looking at each other like, well, that happened.
Right.
And then the phone rings.
Or a phone rings.
No, it's the dude's phone. It's the teacher's phone again. And the dead teacher gets up.
The mostly dead teacher.
Walks over, sits down, has a conversation on the phone with his kid again, gets mad, throws the phone across the room because the kid's still disrespectful. He's trying to say his last words, his dying words. Kid doesn't care. Throws the phone across the room, and he's been eating these cookies out of a bag throughout the movie. He goes, last one, pops the cookie in his mouth and falls over dead. It's cartoony, it's lame, it's unrealistic. Having him get up off the ground was stupid. I thought that killing him, having him lay there was fine. So, balls in your court. Tell me why I'm wrong. No, balls in your court, Travis.
You're not wrong.
Why was that cool?
No,
it's why was that cool one of the top 10 endings of all time?
I exaggerated. No, it's not one of the top 10 endings of all time.
Fuck me. Fuck me. Who cares what I think?
I really enjoyed it. It's just one of my favorite. One of my favorite death scenes.
Because it's goofy?
Because it's just quirky and unexpected. No, does it take you out of the story? Completely. Is it silly and unrealistic? Completely. But I think that's part of the reason I like it. It's like, honestly, I think a lot of this end scene was sort of... This is an educated guess. I don't know if this is the case or not. But I think a lot of it was the director giving Takeshi Kitano a little bit of free rein over... the poetics of the ending. Like I said, he painted the picture himself, and if you see his movies as a filmmaker, but there's a
early high school girl. This is and he's like in his 50s.
He doesn't love her romantically.
He does.
No.
That's what he says in the Requiem.
No. She's the daughter he wished he had.
That's not how he talks to her in the Requiem.
Well, how do you...
He wants to bone this girl. Travis.
I am.
Where's your pedo dar?
All right, I guess you could reinterpret it that way, yeah.
He says he loves her.
That's not the only way you can love someone.
It's a platonic love. Travis is anyway, so into this so actor. He's so into this actor that he's got these blinders on. He's like, it's okay he painted a picture for this girl and confesses his love.
Well, he's a filmmaker too. And if you see a lot of the films that he's made, they're very poetically metaphoric in a lot of ways. So I think it was this filmmaker's way of saying, hey, let you have a little input on the ending. Now, does it completely not match the rest of the film? Yeah.
Character.
After he's mowed down from there to the end of the film, to the end of that scene, it's Takeshi Kitano's portion to let him shine because he's the big star of the movie.
He might be a metaphorical filmmaker, but his character literally wants that ass.
I like it because it's quirky and unexpected. That's the main thing.
Is Battle Royale one of your favorite movies of all time?
It's up there.
I don't think you've admitted to any movies being one of your favorite movies of all time in this whole
list. I have so many.
All I get out of you is, it's up there. It's up there. I wonder, gang, will we ever actually watch one of Travis's favorite films of all time?
Next week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, let's hold off on that because we got a couple more things to address.
One more.
Is there anything you want to add before we move
on? Yes. This is one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite films of all time.
Oh, shit.
And the actress that played the... Not that you're going to know who this is. But the actress that played the character Takako Chigusa... name is Chiaki Kuriyama.
Oh, good.
And Quentin Tarantino hand-selected her to cast her in Kill Bill as Gogo, Yubari.
I don't know who that is either.
In Kill Bill? The little schoolgirl chick. Is that the one with the chain?
Yeah. Oh, cool. She's from Battle Royale. Yeah. I didn't know that.
And you're going to find out also that comes into play here in a few minutes with something we do at the end of every episode. Did you have anything else to add?
No, but I wanted to guess that the Fred Dekker connection was going to have something to do with... because I'm apparently the most racist fuck of all time. There are Asian characters in RoboCop 3.
Nope. So I was going to do with RoboCop 3.
No, nothing?
Nope. Racist fuck.
Why?
No, in fact, I tried so hard to make the connection through Takeshi Kitano because I'm such a big fan of his, but I couldn't make it
clearly work. Confesses his love to a child at the end of the movie, and you're like, he just wants to be it's the daughter he never had.
Anything else, sir? Before we go into Decker territory?
I'm good.
Okay.
Let's do it.
So, I managed to connect this film to Fred Decker beyond all odds. I thought this was going to be the film that finally broke me. I did it in 5 degrees.
Wow. Less than six. Let's hear it.
So, Battle Royale, the movie we spoke about, of course, as we just talked about, starred a young actress by the name of Chiaki Kuriyama, played the character Takako, who, of course, also starred in Kill Bill Volume 2 as Gogo, hand-selected by Quentin Tarantino.
Are you going with Michael...
Madsen?
Michael Madsen, nope. Is that... No? No. See, okay. That's two. I've whiffed on two of them.
So, she was in Kill Bill, directed by Quentin Tarantino. Quentin Tarantino, of course, also directed Reservoir Dogs.
I'll go on the director route. Okay, so, well, Michael Madsen... I'm back on Michael Madsen. Hang on. Who in Reservoir Dogs... No, because it's not... doesn't go directly to Decker. What's next?
Okay. Reservoir Dogs starred Chris Penn as Nice Guy Eddie.
Keep going.
Okay, in the jumpsuit.
I know. Okay.
Chris Penn also starred as Willard in Footloose.
Not John Travolta. We're not going to go John Travolta here.
Who else was in Footloose? None other than the living legend John Lithgow as Reverend Shaw Moore.
John, this is going John Lithgow? What the fuck does John Lithgow have to do with Fred
Decker? Who also starred as Earl Talbot Blake in Ricochet, which was written by Fred Decker.
Holy shit. Holy shit. You got John Lithgow out of this.
But see, those are the actors that are great to
Travis
work with.
Could do this podcast by himself, gang.
Because they've done so many films and worked with so many people. Those are the people you hope to run into.
This is how much knowledge this motherfucker has about movies. Could you imagine me doing this podcast with anybody else? I'd just be sitting here talking about dicks and Asian people all
and it'd be much more interesting.
No.
One more thing.
I always learn about movies when we do a show.
In Shaun of the Dead, there's a Battle Royale poster up in Shaun's living room on the wall.
Oh.
For what that's worth.
All right.
But this movie's had a big influence on a lot of modern filmmakers. A
whole lot, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
talk
yeah.
about it.
In fact, in 2000, let's say it was 2006, there was a lot of talk about adapting a television series in the U.S. that was to air on the CW network.
Wow.
Could you imagine that?
No. I imagine it would suck. Right. There's a brand new movie that just came out a couple weeks ago that owes its rent to Battle Royale. Owes its rent. That's a new saying I just came up with. You remember what that movie is? The office people killing each other?
Oh, yeah. Belko Experiment.
Belko Experiment. Oh, it's rent.
Only it didn't pull it off with Royale. Nearly the success.
Like I said, if you put adults in their place, it wouldn't have had nearly as much resonance. Because when you make it teenage, you talk about melodrama and
see,
and
I think the
stuff.
Belko Experiment...
The idea of having children, they have their whole lives in front of them. They haven't even figured out how to live yet.
Yeah.
That are all in that phase where they're trying to find love. They've never had it before. They're trying, boys just trying to talk to girls. Girls just trying to figure out how to stop being cunts to each other for 5 seconds.
See, the Belko Experiment, they tried to take Office Space and make it corporate.
Well, when it's a bunch of adults and
everybody hates each other in that scenario. Anyway.
And I imagine they're all douchebags
right.
in the movie, because everybody in modern movies are douchebags. I imagine you don't give a fuck who dies, and they just kill them off one by one. The kills aren't very... original, and that's that's one of the things that all the movies we talk about on this show, I think even the really crappy ones, are really well written.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we choose these films is because of how much care is put into the stories of these movies.
It's all about the story. Doesn't matter what the film looks like, how long it is, none of that matters. Good or bad. When it comes to the story, you either have a good story or you don't. If you have a bad story, it doesn't matter what you do, the movie's going to suck. If you have a good story, you could fail on a lot of different areas after that, but as long as you got a good story, it can still be a watchable movie, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that's why story matters.
Well, all right, well, I'm done. Are you done?
I'm good.
All right, so...
We've beaten the hell out of this.
We managed to do Battle Royale.
Yeah.
I'm proud of us.
I am.
Did you have fun?
I did.
I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot.
You taught me
a lot.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Taught me a lot about Asian cinema in this episode. What's next?
What's next? Next episode?
Yeah.
One of my favorite films.
Oh, we get a definitive favorite film from
Travis.
I can
watch this movie every day and never get tired of it.
Every day.
Every day.
He just said every day.
Every day. And I am talking about the classic Don Coscarelli's Beastmaster.
Beastmaster. Yes. Taking a trip down barbarian cinema.
Fantasy Lane. Film. I think it's our first...
A sword and
Willow
sorcery.
Was our first venture into a fantasy film.
This is our second sword and sorcery film. And gang, there will be many more because these are cool fucking movies from the 80s. These movies like Dragon Slayer, Beastmaster, movies like Clash of the Titans.
Legend.
Even though Clash of the Titans was a...
early 80s, 81.
I'm talking about Eretz Sennin.
It's
a Greek mythology.
Yeah.
But it's still, I consider it, for some reason, I consider it sword and sorcery.
Right.
Like for the Harryhausen Hercules or Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, rather, the Sinbad movies.
Mm.
For some reason, I consider those sword and sorcery.
You got Conan and Red Sonja.
Oh my God, those are so good. What else? There's a bunch of good ones.
Oh yeah. There's
a ton of good ones. You said Legend already.
Legend. Well, one I enjoy that's a little not as well known is an Italian one from Lucio Fulci named Conquest.
Yeah, you want to do that? That's on our list of 100, but I've never seen it before. Is that fair? Can we do a movie I've never even seen? I've never seen this movie
before. I'd
be
interested to get a fresh, unadulterated opinion from Kevin Strange on a movie.
Right. Well, gang, till next week, we hope you throw us a buck. Join us over on our Overrun Patreon show. We do a show at patreon.com/KevinStrange every week after our main broadcast. That's only accessible by donating or pledging at least $1 a month to our Patreon. And that's not a dollar per episode. That's a dollar per month, which means you have access to all of our episodes. We're up to, 15, 16 Overrun episodes?
This is number 15 we just finished.
So 50, jump in now, you get 15 Overrun episodes available to listen to. It's a lot of fun over there, gang. We talk about the movies we're currently watching, things we've watched in the last week, in the last month. We talk about all kinds of stuff. We talk about documentaries. I talk a lot about documentaries.
There we do.
War stuff, political stuff, cultural stuff. And the only way you can hear that is by dropping us a buck. What does a buck get us?
Yeah.
What does a buck matter? A buck matters because if 150 of you motherfuckers throw us a buck a month, that's enough to buy convention tables.
Yeah.
That's enough to maybe entice a B-movie actor or actress to join us on this show.
Yeah, and what does that buy you outside of this, you know? I mean, what do you want, a soda, a candy bar, a McChicken, you know?
Can you imagine if Travis got to talk to, what is his name, Beat Takeshi?
Takeshi Kitano?
Beat Takano or Beat Takeshi? What is he called?
Well, his name is Takeshi Kitano, but he goes by Beat Takeshi as an actor.
Imagine if Travis got to sit here and talk about that. And ask him why he calls himself something weird.
This is a weird guy, I suspect.
Well, I mean, considering... Never mind. Alright, so gang, till next week, remember to keep
watching.
All music heard on the Watching with Strangers podcast, courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/.